Welcome to our deep dive into the Galilee.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm already fascinated by what I've seen in these sources.
Oh, yeah.
We've got maps that detail the region, key biblical passages, and even some archaeological reports, including findings from a first century boat.
Really? A first century boat? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. So, you know, with all of this, I think we have everything we need to not only understand the where of Jesus' ministry, but also to get a real sense of what daily life was like back then.
Yeah, like stepping into a time machine.
Exactly. So First things first, when we say Galilee today, what exactly are we talking about?
That's a great question. You know, we tend to picture a peaceful countryside when we hear Galilee, but the Galilee back then was a much more complex region. It was a land between empires shaped by layers of history.
Okay.
From the Assyrian exile to the influence of Hellenistic culture and, of course, the ever-present power of Rome.
So not exactly a quiet backwater, more like a cultural and political crossroad.
Precisely. And this makes Isaiah's prophecy in Isaiah 9:1-2 all the more intriguing. You know, he refers to the Galilee of the Gentiles, which highlights the diverse population that would come to characterize this region.
Mm.
This wasn't a place of homogeneity. It was a melting pot of cultures and beliefs.
And how do you think this diversity might have shaped Jesus's ministry? Did having to connect with such a varied audience influence his approach or message?
It's certainly something to consider. Imagine trying to convey a message that resonates with people from such different backgrounds, each with their own unique set of beliefs and expectations.
Yeah.
It must have required a remarkable sensitivity and adaptability on Jesus's part.
Okay, so we've got this dynamic cultural landscape.
Yeah.
What about the physical landscape? What was the Galilee like geographically?
Well, the lower Galilee, where Jesus spent much of his time, was characterized by these east-west valleys.
Yeah.
Beautiful, yes.
Right.
But they also functioned as natural wind tunnels.
So these valleys were funneling winds. Where were they coming from?
From the Mediterranean, carrying moisture-laden air that would sweep across the region and slam right into the Sea of Galilee. This explains why the sea was known for its sudden violent storms.
This completely changes how I read those gospel stories about Jesus calming the storms. You're out on this relatively small body of water, and all of a sudden this ferocious storm kicks up.
Exactly. It makes those accounts so much more visceral and immediate. You can practically feel the wind whipping around you, the waves crashing against the boat. It was a dangerous place to be caught in a storm.
Yeah, but speaking of locations, there's a rather curious move Jesus makes early in his ministry. He shifts his base from Nazareth to Capernaum, seemingly moving away from the Roman power center in Sepphoris.
Yeah.
What was the strategic thinking behind that decision?
Well, Capernaum, while maybe not as politically prominent as Sepphoris, was far from a sleepy little town.
Okay.
In fact, it was a bustling hub of commerce. It was known for fishing, of course, being right on the Sea of Galilee. But it was also a center for olive oil production. Archaeologists have uncovered numerous olive presses in Capernaum.
Olive presses?
Wow.
I had no idea. So it was more than just a fishing village. It sounds like they had a thriving olive oil industry.
It seems so. And this economic activity would have made Capernaum a significant town, attracting merchants and traders from all over the region. It was also located near a key trade route and was a tax collection point, which means it was a crossroads for all sorts of people.
Ah, so this wasn't just a random choice. Moving to Capernaum put Jesus right in the heart of a bustling and diverse community.
Oh, precisely. It was a strategic move, allowing him to interact with a wide range of people from different backgrounds and walks of life.
This deep dive is really making me rethink my assumptions about the Galilee. It's a much more complex and dynamic place than I ever imagined. And speaking of complexity, one of the sources mentioned a rather chilling historical event, Herod's brutal attack on Arbel, just a generation before Jesus.
Yes. That event, as recounted by Josephus, would have left a lasting impact on the region. Imagine these sheer cliffs riddled with caves that were used for defense. They would have been a constant reminder of the region's violent past.
It makes Matthew's use of Isaiah 9:1-2 even more powerful. The people of that time, hearing Jesus proclaimed as the Prince of Peace, they would have immediately understood the significance of those words against that backdrop of violence and conflict.
Absolutely. It's like a direct response to the region's troubled history, offering hope and healing in a place that had known so much turmoil. And this brings us back to Capernaum, where archaeological remains, particularly those of the insula housing, provide a fascinating glimpse into daily life back then.
Insula housing? What are those like?
They were typical of Jewish villages in the Galilee picture, interconnected housing units often built around a central courtyard.
Right.
Extended families would live together in these structures, adding rooms as the family grew. It would have been a very communal way of life.
So when Jesus spoke about preparing a place in his father's house, Would those familiar with this type of housing have understood his words differently?
It's certainly possible. His words would have resonated deeply with those who lived in such close-knit family units where the concept of home extended beyond just the individual dwelling.
It's amazing how understanding the physical and social context can add new layers of meaning to even the most familiar passages. It's like we're seeing Jesus' teachings through the eyes of his original audience.
That's the power of archaeology and historical research. It allows us to bridge the gap between our modern world and the ancient world of Jesus.
And speaking of bridging the gap, one of the sources described the discovery of a first-century boat found in the mud when the Sea of Galilee's water levels dropped. This wasn't Jesus' boat, but it gives us a real sense of what it would have been like to be out on those waters.
It's a remarkable find. Imagine this boat, preserved for centuries, offers a tangible link to the past. It's the type of vessel Jesus and his disciples might have used facing the same unpredictable weather and navigating the same waters.
It really brings those gospel stories to life. You can practically feel the rocking of the waves, the spray of the water, the sense of both awe and danger that those fishermen must have experienced on a daily basis. This deep dive is already transforming how I understand the Galilee, and we haven't even gotten to Caesarea Philippi yet.
There's so much more to explore. But before we move on, let's take a closer look at some of the other findings from Capernaum. The synagogue there, believed to have been built on the foundations of a first century synagogue, possibly the one where Jesus taught, is particularly fascinating.
Okay, let's delve into that. What makes this synagogue so special?
It seems the synagogue at Capernaum was quite ornate, especially compared to other synagogues from that time period.
Oh, that's interesting. Why would that be?
Well, some scholars believe that by the time that synagogue was built, there was a significant Christian community in Capernaum. Knowing that pilgrims would be drawn to sites associated with Jesus' ministry, perhaps this elaborate synagogue was a way to attract those pilgrims and showcase the place where Jesus had preached.
So it wasn't just a place of worship, but potentially a way to share Jesus' message with the wider world and maybe even boost the local economy. That really connects the dots between faith history and even economics.
It does, doesn't it? It makes you think about the ripple effects of Jesus' ministry, how it impacted not just individuals, but entire communities.
Absolutely. Now let's shift gears a bit and talk about the Sea of Galilee itself. It's more than just a picturesque body of water, right?
Right. In ancient times, large bodies of water, especially seas and oceans, held a sense of fear and mystery. They were often seen as representing chaos, even the abyss.
So when we read about Jesus calming the storms or walking on water, it's not just a display of miraculous power.
Yeah.
It's a powerful statement about his authority over nature, over forces that were deeply feared.
Exactly. And those miracles would have had a profound impact on the people who witnessed them, especially those whose livelihoods depended on the sea. Remember, the Sea of Galilee wasn't just a source of fear, it was also a source of livelihood. People relied on it for fishing, of course, but also the fertile plains surrounding the sea were perfect for growing olives and grapes.
That brings us back to Capernaum and its thriving olive oil industry. This makes me think about those warnings Jesus gave about millstones and the depths of the sea. To people who lived and worked by the sea, this wasn't just a metaphor. It was a very real and terrifying image.
You're absolutely right. Jesus used imagery that was deeply rooted in their everyday experiences, making his teachings all the more impactful and relatable. And speaking of relatable, let's revisit that incredible first century boat found in the mud. It really does offer an incredible window into the past, doesn't it?
It does. What strikes me is how the boat itself becomes a tangible connection to the stories we read in the Gospels.
Precisely. This wasn't a luxury vessel. This was a working boat, the kind that would have been used for fishing transportation, everyday life. It helps us visualize what it might have been like for Jesus and his disciples to be out on those waters, facing the same challenges, experiencing the same awe and wonder.
Before we leave Capernaum, I want to circle back to the archaeological remains there, specifically the synagogue and the insula housing structures. What stood out to you about those?
The insula housing is particularly insightful. As we discussed earlier, those interconnected rooms and central courtyards were a common feature of Jewish villages in the Galilee, extended families living together, expanding their homes as new generations were born. It was a very communal way of life.
And this communal aspect makes me think about how Jesus's teachings would have been received. For example, when he spoke about preparing a place in his Father's house, would that have resonated differently with people who were so accustomed to this shared living experience?
It's a fascinating question. Perhaps his words took on a deeper meaning for those who understood the concept of home as extending beyond just their individual dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
It suggests a sense of belonging, of being part of a larger family, a spiritual family.
and we can't forget about the synagogue at Capernaum. It's incredible to think that we can still see the remains of a place where Jesus may have taught.
It is. And the fact that it might have been built on the foundation of an even earlier synagogue, possibly from Jesus's time, adds another layer of significance.
It's a powerful reminder that even though we're separated by centuries, we're still connected to those early followers of Jesus. We're part of that same story, that same unfolding of faith. Now, you mentioned earlier that Jesus' journey to Caesarea Philippi wasn't just a casual trip. What can you tell us about this location and why it was so significant?
Caesarea Philippi, located at the foot of Mount Hermon, wasn't just geographically important. It was a prominent pagan religious center. Imagine temples dedicated to Pan-Zeus Nemesis. Even Herod the Great built a temple there dedicated to Augustus.
Wow, a real clash of belief systems.
Exactly. It was a place where different faiths and ideologies collided, a true battleground of ideas. And it's against this backdrop that Jesus asks his disciples that all-important question, who do you say I am?
What a powerful moment to be surrounded by these symbols of pagan worship and then to be asked to define Jesus's identity. It really puts them on the spot, doesn't it?
It does. It's a pivotal moment in their faith journey, a moment that forces them to confront what they truly believe. And it's a question that still resonates with us today, doesn't it? We're constantly being challenged to define our own beliefs, to choose who or what we will follow.
And the fact that Jesus chose to ask this question in a place where paganism was so prominent adds another layer of meaning, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's deliberately setting up a contrast, a challenge to the prevailing beliefs of the time.
You're right. It's a deliberate confrontation, a clash of worldviews. He's asking them and us to choose between the gods of this world and the one true God.
And Peter, in a moment of incredible clarity, declares, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God."
Yeah.
Such a bold declaration of faith in the face of those pagan gods.
It is. But as we know, Peter didn't fully grasp the implications of his own words at that point. He still had a lot to learn about what it truly meant to follow Jesus.
It's a good reminder that faith is a journey, not a destination. We're always growing and learning and deepening our understanding of who Jesus is. Speaking of journeys, one of the sources mentioned the Transfiguration, a pivotal moment in Jesus's ministry. Traditionally, this event is associated with Mount Tabor, but it seems more likely that it took place on Mount Hermon.
Yes, Mount Hermon, the highest peak in the region, a place of breathtaking beauty and grandeur. It's fitting, don't you think, that such a momentous event would take place on such a grand stage?
Absolutely. And Mount Hermon wasn't just geographically impressive, was it?
No, it wasn't. Remember, Mount Hermon was also steeped in religious significance. It was associated with the ancient Canaanite god Baal, and there were likely pagan shrines located on its slopes.
So once again, we have this juxtaposition of paganism and the message of Jesus. It's like a deliberate confrontation of belief systems.
Exactly. The Transfiguration isn't just about Jesus revealing his glory. It's about him claiming his authority over all other powers and principalities. It's about him declaring himself as the true Lord, the one to whom all creation bows.
And the fact that Moses and Elijah appear alongside Jesus adds another layer of significance.
Absolutely. Their presence represents the law and the prophets, the very foundation of the Jewish faith. It's as if Jesus is being affirmed, endorsed by those who came before him.
And then to top it all off, we have the voice from heaven. "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." What a powerful affirmation of Jesus' identity and mission.
It's the culmination of everything we've been exploring, wouldn't you say? The geography, the history, the theology. It all points to this ultimate truth. Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who has come to redeem and restore all creation.
And from this high point, this mountaintop experience, that Jesus sets his sights on Jerusalem.
Yes. And we know what's coming, the journey to the cross, the ultimate sacrifice. But before we delve into those events, there's one more stop on our deep dive through the Galilee, a place that's rich in symbolism and offers a profound insight into the nature of faith.
This is exciting. You've really piqued my curiosity. Tell me more.
Welcome back to our deep dive into the Galilee. We've explored so much already, from the bustling streets of Capernaum to the windswept Sea of Galilee and the heights of Mount Hermon. Now, you've mentioned one last stop, a place that reveals something profound about faith. Where are we headed?
We're going back to the foot of Mount Hermon to a site called Caesarea Philippi. At first glance, it might not seem like much, but it holds a powerful symbolism, especially when we consider it within the context of Jesus' ministry. Okay, I'm intrigued. Paint me a picture of this place. What would I see if I were standing there back in Jesus' time?
Imagine a massive cliff face riddled with caves and niches, each one dedicated to a different pagan deity. Water gushes from a spring, feeding the headwaters of the Jordan River. The ancients considered this a sacred site, a place where the gods were believed to dwell.
So this wasn't just a geographical location. It was a spiritual battleground, a place where pagan beliefs held sway. And it's here in the shadow of those pagan shrines that Jesus asks his disciples that crucial question, "Who do you say I am?"
Precisely. It's a deliberate confrontation. Jesus isn't just asking for a theological definition. He's challenging his disciples to consider the very foundation of their worldview. It's a choice between the gods of this world and the one true God.
And amidst all that, Peter makes his bold declaration, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." It's a powerful statement of faith, especially when you consider the setting.
It is. And this is where we revisit Jesus' response to Peter, "On this rock I will build my church." Remember we talked about the different interpretations of that preposition epi?
Yes, the idea that it could be translated as against rather than on. So instead of the church being built on Peter, it's built against something.
Exactly. It suggests a more militant stance, a church built in opposition to the very forces represented by those pagan shrines at Caesarea Philippi. It's a declaration of spiritual warfare, a call to resist the idols of the world, whatever form they may take.
That's a powerful concept. It's not just about believing in Jesus. It's about actively opposing those forces that stand against him.
And that idea resonates with another concept we discussed earlier, the rabbinic tradition about the gates of Hades collapsing at Caesarea Philippi when the Messiah arrives.
That's right. It's like a symbolic victory over the forces of darkness.
It's a powerful image that speaks to the ongoing struggle between good and evil, a struggle that continues to this day.
And that brings us to the heart of what this deep dive has been all about, hasn't it?
Mm.
It's not just about accumulating facts and information. It's about understanding the context that challenges the spiritual realities that shape Jesus' ministry.
And it's about applying those insights to our own lives. What idols do we need to confront? What forces do we need to stand against? What does it mean for us to be the church in our own time and place?
This has been an incredible journey. We've covered so much ground, literally and figuratively. And I have to say, my understanding of the Galilee has been completely transformed.
I'm glad to hear that. And as we wrap up our deep dive, I encourage you to reflect on what resonated most with you. What aha moment stood out? How has your understanding of Jesus and his ministry been enriched by exploring these locations and their significance?
The Galilee is more than just a historical setting. It's a place where faith and history collide, a place that still speaks to us today. And for me, that's the most powerful takeaway of all.
Well said. And I hope this deep dive has inspired you to continue exploring, to keep digging deeper into the scriptures, to keep asking questions, and to keep the faith.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Galilee. Until next time, keep exploring.